more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study.
You guys are sort of all over the world, it seems like.
It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
Here on Inspiration Dissemination.
But there's actually photographs of this data set stretching over a much longer period of time.
They're now converted into basically mathematical shapes, and we can now analyze the statistics of this shape.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners.
KBVR Corvallis. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Matt Vaughn.
And I'm Joseph Valencia. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students and postdoctoral fellows in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of those students each week. If you're a graduate student or a postdoc at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or if you just want to find out more about all the awesome things going on at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our up-and-coming guests and links to our Twitter and podcast pages.
This episode of Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and tonight on the show, our guest is Elena Konser. She is a third-year PhD student in the Integrative Biology Department, and she works in the Plankton Ecology Lab. So thanks for joining us, Elena.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great to have you on board. So we'll start. You can just give us a little overview of our research, what you're doing here and what your research involves.
Yeah, sure. So I study zooplankton ecology in the California current ecosystem. So I ask questions about how oceanography affects different plankton communities and what that means.
So what that means is a good segue to just a very basic question I have, which is, what is plankton?
Yeah, so when a lot of people hear the word plankton, they think of like SpongeBob, the little guy with one eye and antennas. But plankton is actually kind of like this group of organisms that's has nothing to do with how they're related or anything, but it's just things that are unable to swim against the currents and just float through the ocean. There's a lot of different kinds of plankton. There's phytoplankton, which are plants, so they use the sun to make energy, and there's zooplankton, which are animals that are spend some of their lives as plankton, or some spend all of their lives as plankton. But plankton is really just this really broad class of organisms that form a community in the oceans.
Right, and what I found interesting when we had a chat before, which I didn't really know, but jellyfish can be defined as plankton, right?
Yeah, so jellyfish, if you think about them, they're just kind of these blobs of watery goo. They're not particularly good at swimming, and so they're kind of carried throughout the ocean wherever the currents take them, so they're considered plankton, which is one of the reasons why you see like big groups of jellyfish walked onto the beach, is because they can't control where they swim, so they're just moved by the currents.
But typically when you think of classically plankton, then we're talking about much smaller organisms?
So plankton, there's a very wide range of organisms that can be plankton, so stuff like viruses, even though they're not considered by the scientific community really to be alive, are considered to be plankton. Same thing with like bacteria, and then all the way up to things like jellyfish. The order of magnitude that we deal with in plankton is, I think Matt wrote about this in the blog, but it's one of my favorite facts about plankton, is that if you take the smallest plankton to the largest plankton and compare them in size, it's the same as comparing a human being to the size of the Earth.
Oh, wow.
So it's just like very broad sizes and types of organisms are considered plankton.
We're all little plankton living on a big jellyfish, basically.
That's exactly what we are.
Cool. So, there's obviously a massive diversity, not only in size, but also, classification and type of plankton. Are you looking at every plankton out there ever? Are you looking at a specific species? What's your focus with your research?
Some of the main areas of focus of my research is on what are called mesozooplankton, which is kind of this like medium size range of plankton. And again, mostly animals, but a big kind of area of my research and the research my lab does studies on is on larval fish. So early life stages of fish are considered plankton. They're called meroplankton, which is animals that only spend a part of their life cycle in the plankton. So I kind of focus on larval fish and their predators and their prey within the plankton. So there's kind of this food web nestled just within the plankton that is kind of what I focus on.
And so can you say a little bit about what the fish are like at that stage of development? You know, I have this image of fish as being nothing if not mobile, but so what are they like at this stage of their development?
Yeah, larval fish, I would say, are less fishy and more wormy. So larval fish are, you know, days to weeks old. They're not very old. And a lot of them, they don't have scales. They don't have real fins. Most of them look like just small little worms. And they don't really have much control of where they're going. They're not very mobile. And as they grow, they gain more and more ability to be able to swim and then exit their plankton stage to live adult life.
Right. And you mentioned food webs in there when, you know, you were talking about larval fish. Can you explain why their planktonic stage is so important, you know, in relation to community ecology and food web connectivity?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of get this question a lot from, like, my family, like, why do I care about a 5-millimeter fish? So fish, most of the time, there's exceptions, of course, as with everything in science, but most fish are broadcast spawners where the adults get together and just release their reproductive matter into the ocean and then just kind of hope for the best. So some fish can produce up to like 100 million eggs. And so their kind of strategy is to just overwhelm the system with so many babies that some of them survive. So a lot of fish have up to 99% mortality within like their larval stage. So the reason why we study this is because that 1% survivorship, if you change that even just a little bit, is going to have a lot of ramifications for the population. If 99.1% have mortality rather than 99, that's a huge change, even though it doesn't actually seem like it from a numerical part of view. So studying the early life stages of fish is extremely important for the population dynamics, because small alterations can cause big changes down the line.
Right, yeah. And I guess that relates to us. I love seafood myself, so if there's less plankton survivorship, then, you know, ultimately that could mean less fish, right? And what I'm getting at is the impacts of plankton go upstream up the food web, so larger organisms could be impacted, right?
Yeah, so talking about like plankton in general, the whole basis of the oceanic food webs is based in plankton, starting out with single cellular phytoplankton, then up to zooplankton and fish and beyond that. Everything in the ocean depends on plankton to live. So it's one of the most important things to study when we talk about fisheries and all those species that everybody loves, and those very, you know, more friendly, like whales and tuna and stuff, all of that depends on plankton for survival.
So we're here in Oregon. I imagine you focus on sort of a region of of the ocean where you're collecting plankton. Do you want to say a bit about that environment?
Yeah, so the region that I do my research in is called the Northern California Current. So the California Current is kind of this very large scale ecosystem off the west coast of the United States. It's, when you think of like a current, you think of like something small, or like Finding Nemo, East Australian Current, just like this like small bit of water moving really fast. But in this case, like the California Current, it's this very wide, slow current. And this region is particularly interesting to study because of the what's called upwelling, which creates lots of nutrients in the surface water, which all the phytoplankton, the little plant guys, really like. And so it creates this like super productive ecosystem where there's lots of fish and lots of animals, and that's kind of the region where I focus my study.
Interesting. So you've got, on one hand, you've got excess nutrients, which could benefit some types of plankton, but in the upwelling region, it's also characterized by low oxygen, correct? So are plankton negatively impacted by the low oxygen?
Yeah, so as Matt said, these areas of low oxygen kind of form related to this input of nutrients in the system. And so usually low oxygen forms close to the seafloor. And the kind of the question of, are plankton affected by low oxygen, isn't one that we really have an answer to. And that's, you know, the focus of my PhD work is kind of, how do we understand how oxygen affects plankton? It's really obvious the way low oxygen can affect other organisms, like what lives on the bottom, like crabs. You see lots of them wash up and die, so we know that's bad. But we don't really know how it affects things that are floating in the water versus things that are stuck on the bottom.
Right, and especially that they're at the mercy of the physical processes of the current. So are you looking at different depth ranges? And I guess, first of all, we should take a step back, and how do you even look at plankton? They're so tiny for the most part. Like, how do you go out and observe them?
Yeah, so the most kind of traditional way of looking at plankton is you take a net, you put it in the water, you scoop it out, and you look at what you see. Like, that's like how people have been studying plankton for, you know, hundreds of years. And we still do that. I still do that for my research to an extent. We have a little bit more sophisticated net systems where we can vertically stratify where we're sampling, so we can have nets that take smaller bits of water and we know where that came from. But it still doesn't give us a lot of very high resolution information on plankton. Usually the resolution we can get is 10 meters or like 30 feet of water vertically stratified sampling. So the kind of technology that my lab group uses and I focus on for a lot of my research is using plankton imaging systems. So it's these large kind of, I don't know, like go-kart sized instruments that have cameras on them and a bunch of different environmental sensors for measuring things like oxygen and salinity and depth and pH and all kinds of stuff. And we take this basically really, really fancy camera system and put it in the ocean and record. And we get these super long videos of data that's pictures of the plankton, what co-occurring with different species, and then also with very high resolution data on the environmental conditions. So with nets, you can kind of get in the resolution of, like I said, 10 meters, but with plankton imaging, we can go to like 1 centimeter resolution.
So a lot of resolution in space and a lot of length and time. What goes into processing a lot of that data that you get from the collection system?
Yeah, so as people with like phones probably know, video data is really expensive in memory to holds. So we kind of coming back from these research cruises with like 30 terabytes of plankton imagery data just on hard drives. Mm-hmm. And you know, it would be impossible to go through that by hand. I think I counted from like our last research cruise, we had over 1.8 billion plankton individually that wow. we imaged. And so we don't do this by hand. My lab group has kind of developed, and we continue to develop and refine a deep learning pipeline to basically automatically identify the plankton images from these videos.
So that's based on a library, I imagine. And that's something your lab put together? So through that, what details of the plankton can you see? Are you able to see specific species?
Yeah, so we can see, for some groups, we can see species. For others, we can't get quite that high of resolution just from the images, but overall we have 170 different classes, basically, that we can identify from these plankton images. So from that last cruise, we took those 1.8 billion pictures and separated them into 170 different groups.
And you mentioned that your specific focus is on hypoxia. How do you relate, like what qualities of these videos are indicative of how they're responding to oxygen levels?
Yeah, so from these data, I basically create some, I take the abundance of the plankton and I look at how that relates to different environmental conditions. The data we work with, just the nature of it, some plankton are very abundant, some of them aren't. Ends up being like very messy data, about the furthest thing from normally distributed you could possibly imagine. So we have to do a lot of really interesting things to actually try to tease apart these relationships with oxygen. So a lot of this involves like building machine learning models to take the data and try to extract patterns from it. But a lot of the kind of interpretation of these analyses is based on like physiological studies that have been done by other people. Because you can see a pattern, but you being able to actually relate that has to like be based on previous knowledge.
Yeah, I could imagine making inferences from that data could be really challenging. I mean, you've got 170 classes of plankton, and you've obviously got samples from different regions of the ocean, you know, geographically, but also vertically, with different environmental conditions. So how do you, I guess, what does that information tell you? Because you mentioned the plankton can't swim against the current. So are they in an area just where they happen to, you know, just where the gametes sort of came, or were they forced to a specific area based on physical processes, or how do you, I guess, infer information from what groups you find where?
So I guess I should say that some plankton can swim a little bit. It's not like they can, you know, really control where they're at, but they can swim up and down. So usually plankton have a limited ability for vertical migration. And that's also very dependent on what kind of plankton you're talking about and how old they are. Like a larger larval fish will be able to swim better than a younger one. What was I trying to say? Oh yeah, so a lot of the kind of the questions that I'm asked with relating to the low dissolved oxygen is related to like abundance. So if we see higher abundance in low dissolved oxygen, that could mean a few different things. That could mean either they're stuck there, they can't escape the low dissolved oxygen, or it could mean that they prefer it. Oxygen's, you know, a very important thing for almost everything that's alive. So usually not having oxygen is a bad thing, but there's different tolerances that animals might have. Things that have lower metabolic demand might be able to tolerate hypoxia or low oxygen to some extent, and they could actually potentially choose that area of low oxygen to take advantage of prey items that can't tolerate low oxygen. So from the data, I can get these really good patterns, and I can see that some groups have a higher abundance in low oxygen relative, but actually understanding about why they might be there, whether or not they're stuck, or if they prefer it, or if they're tolerating it, comes from a lot of background knowledge.
You had mentioned that in your thesis you have these sort of sub-problems all related to hypoxia and plankton. What are some of those questions that you're answering in sort of discrete chunks?
Yeah, so my first major question that I am focusing on is just how are plankton communities in the Northern California current region influenced by hypoxia? And then that in itself has a lot of different sub-questions, like how does it affect the abundance? How does it affect vertical distribution of different groups? How does community composition change within and around hypoxic waters? How are predator-prey interactions influenced by the presence of low-dissolved oxygen waters? And so those questions I all use this imaging system to answer. And I love talking about plankton imaging, but there's only so many questions that you can answer using just like a picture of something. Even if we have lots of pictures and lots of detail, and there's only so many questions you can answer.
Sure.
And so we go back to the nets and back to kind of the more brute force science of scooping things out of the water. And so I'm focusing as another part of my PhD research on how larval and juvenile stages of a flatfish are influenced by low dissolved oxygen. And to answer those kind of questions, I have to actually have physical samples and not just virtual plankton pictures.
So they're the biological net samples that you also collect on your cruise. When you get those samples, so I imagine they're just tiny larval fish. What are you doing with those samples, and how do you pair those with your imaging observations?
So net samples. So the other thing about larval fish is they're extremely rare members of the plankton. Mm-hmm. So when we get these nets and these net samples back, it takes like thousands of man hours to sort through all of them and get the fish out. It's even more effort than like honestly anything else that I do in my lab, and it takes a lot of work just to get the larval fish out from the plankton. I forgot the rest of your question.
Well, I think you mentioned something to me about looking at their ear bones. I was wondering if you could explain that a little bit more to the listeners.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So the main reason we take these biological samples is to have an actual like fish in our hands, and so a lot of the questions that we like to ask about the early life stages of fish, coming back to when I was talking about things like 99 versus 99.91% mortality, a lot of the questions that we ask about how that is affected comes from information we get from the ear bones of fish. They're called otoliths, and I always say like it's like a tree ring, but actually I think fish evolutionarily came before trees, so I guess trees are like an otolith.
Really?
But that's another one of my favorite fun facts. But tree rings and otoliths, I guess, are similar in that they put on rings, and those rings of or like on a tree are proportional to growth. And they also tell you the age. So for larval fish, you can take out their otoliths, and there's little rings in them, and you can count how many days old the fish are, and then how much they were growing on a particular day. So getting that kind of data where you can calculate a growth of an animal on a singular day allows you to relate that to environmental conditions, and then that allows us to understand these different ways that survivorship of fish is influenced by the environmental conditions.
Yeah, and you mentioned that in the hypoxic areas, they might be there by choice. There could be some advantage. So can you link, I guess, the age data that you get from the otoliths to, you know, the hypoxic regions and see if maybe they're spending longer time there, maybe they're spending a shorter time there?
Yeah, that's something I'd love to be able to try to do. So I'm mostly looking at juvenile fish within hypoxic zones, and I'm just catching them there. And so the kind of growth data I'm looking at is in the most recent growth, because if I catch them in an area where the oxygen is really low, and it has been for the last few days, then they basically have been forced to be within that low oxygen area within that time.
One question I had was, how much change over time in sort of these ocean current systems affects the kind of results that you could get out of your studies? Like, specifically, with climate change and stuff like that, I imagine that there are changes to hypoxic regions that come from that. So how do you disentangle what is coming from what, sort of? And then another piece of that would be, like, have you been able to relate the survival, like you mentioned, like a 1%-ish or something, like, are you able to look at variation in year by year and say hypoxia is also varying and then survival is also varying? Is there any connections you can make in that sense?
Ideally, I'd like to be able to make those connections, but kind of the questions that I'm able to ask are more so less in a survivorship way, because survivorship is measured kind of indirectly from the fish, because I don't really have the dead ones. I only have the ones that are alive still.
Right, yeah.
And luckily, for my juvenile fish that I have, they're a flat fish, so it's like a halibut, so they live on the bottom, so they can't really escape up into the water towards more oxygen, so they're, like, stuck there. But I have samples that I took from areas with hypoxia and then areas without them. So fish of the same age, I can kind of look at how their growth is affected and kind of inform whether or not they're able to tolerate it.
Sure.
Right. And I think on your question there, your question was sort of related to historical data sets for plankton, and one of the coolest things about your research that I just want to circle back to is the technology you use. It sounds really cutting edge for the field. Like, my study organism is, you know, probably the size of my finger or hand, and I struggle to record that. So it sounds like you can get some really cool data, and I'm just interested in how that has changed the field and what sort of questions you can ask with your research, but also just with that data that you get.
Yeah, so I'll say first though, a lot of data is both a blessing and a curse. Sometimes there's just kind of so many questions that I have that I don't even want to start going at them because I'll never stop. So a lot of the questions that I guess nobody has really collected data on as high of resolution as my lab group has, and also for the amount of time we have data now. It doesn't sound like that long, but from 2016 to 2023, and all of this data is on this, like, extremely fine resolution. More traditional plankton sampling methods integrates over water columns. So when you get your net back, you have a bunch of stuff mixed together, but you don't know if that was at, you know, the surface or if it was, you know, 50 feet down. That's all going to be in the same sample. And it's not really likely that what's in there is all co-occurring together. even though it looks like it from a net sample, that's not a really good image of what's happening within the water. So these kind of plankton imaging applications give us kind of a view into the plankton that's like impossible to see. I always, when we're out on at research cruises collecting the data, we live stream the kind of this camera feed from the plankton imager, and it's, they call it plankton TV. It's kind of this like live view of what's going on in the ocean as we're seeing it. And that's kind of, I just think about, that's something that nobody else has really ever seen before. Before we, like, we're, with nets, you get kind of broad brush strokes, but with imaging systems, you really get incredibly fine detail about where things are and who's interacting with who. And it's much easier to relate that to the environmental conditions when you actually can place one plankton with the different conditions being experienced by it.
Interesting. Very cool. So maybe to shift a little bit, how did you come across this line of research? How did you get interested in similar questions?
How did I start studying like plankton?
Yeah, or just go back as far as you want. Like, when did you know you wanted to be working in ocean science, in science?
Yeah, I guess I didn't really know I wanted to go into science until like the end of high school, when I was going to apply to college and kind of just went for it. I applied to kind of places randomly all over the country. I'm actually from Albany, Oregon, grown up here. Yeah. but I ended up doing my undergraduate at the University of Miami in Florida, which is about as far as you can possibly go from here. Looked like there was a school that was good for science, and so I got a scholarship and decided, why not go there? And, you know, we're not far from the ocean here, but not exactly close, but I kind of knew that ocean was really important as far as I had learned in school before, so I thought, that seems like a good field to go into that'll be interesting, and probably job security with like climate change, like people are gonna want to study the ocean. But I had no idea what I wanted to do. I took an intro lab for marine science and kind of got introduced to larval fish through the professor that was teaching it, and I got kind of involved with research in plankton through there, and I didn't even know that fish had like a larval stage or anything like that. But so it was kind of this like extremely complex world that exists in the ocean that I had no idea about before, and so that kind of got me interested in larval fish. And then this is actually like I think it's an interesting story. The lab that I'm now in used to have this, or they still do actually have this website called Plankton Portal that takes images from our plankton imaging system and puts them online, and like it's like a citizen science game thing where you can identify plankton. And I came across that as an undergraduate, and that's kind of how I got introduced to plankton imaging systems, and kind of got more and more interested in plankton and the applications of plankton imaging systems, because it's kind of this intersection of ecology and oceanography and data science that is just really exciting and never boring. And so that's how I ended up basically coming back home, was to work on this plankton imaging system and with my advisor currently.
Cool. So it was really the technology that you're using in your research, and also I guess a bigger, broader ecological questions that you're able to tackle looking at the some of the smallest organisms.
Yeah, I'm really drawn to plankton because they are kind of at the mercy of their environment, right? The whole definition of plankton is anything that's just floating around, which, yeah, from a philosophical point of view, I think is really fun because, you know, we probably all feel like that sometimes, mm-hmm. like we're just at the mercy of the currents of the world. But also, from like a purely scientific point of view, it's really interesting to be able to ask questions about oceanographic conditions and have them be able to be directly tied to the organism that you're studying, because that's the major driver of their location.
Yeah, and I just I have one more research question that I want to ask you. You've obviously got a ton of data, so you might not have an answer for it, but have you observed any trends in certain larval like larval fish plankton like in your data set, and what could this mean in the future?
I don't want to sound too hopeful, but I am pretty hopeful about it.
Yay, positive.
Yeah, some of my preliminary results kind of show that species might be more tolerant than previously thought. Mm. I'm still kind of picking apart why we might be seeing that, but it seems like we're still finding plankton in decently high abundances, even in low oxygen. It depends on the taxa, but a lot of different groups we're seeing have pretty high tolerances. Other groups not, but I'd say more than I anticipated, there are groups of plankton that are tolerant, and most of which are gelatinous zooplankton, though. So jellyfish mm-hmm. tend to not care if there's oxygen or not.
Awesome. Cool. Sounds like some cautiously optimistic news for the fish availability in the next couple months, years.
I really hope so.
No doom and gloom. So where do you see yourself going from here? I know you're in your third year, so you've still got a while to go. But what's your career path like in the future that you envision? And do you plan on using that imaging system sort of throughout your career, or yeah?
Yeah, I'm pretty like obsessed with this plankton imaging system. I think it's like the coolest thing ever. And I love the ability to ask research questions that have never been able to be asked before, because they just were impossible to. And this opens so many new doors to research questions, and I would love to continue working with plankton imaging for my career, especially now that like my lab is kind of developing some different versions of the plankton imaging system for different locations. Like lab has I don't have anything to do with it, but they have a freshwater project, so they've been doing plankton imaging in freshwater. There's plankton in freshwater too, in case you didn't know that.
I did not.
So being able to take plankton imaging to new locations, I think that would be really cool, and I'm already kept up at night with how many questions I don't have the time to ask during my graduate studies, so I'd love to continue to be able to doing that.
It sounds like you will, with the passion that you've got for it.
Yeah, so maybe that brings us to one of the traditions that we like to do to sort of close out the show, which is to ask you, what is the favorite part of your research?
Favorite part of my research, other than everything, it's not entirely true. Everybody has bad days.
Not the sorting the nets exhaustively.
Yeah, I mean, I find there to be a certain charm to lab work too, like under a microscope, even though I spend a lot of time on my computer. But I think, yeah, my favorite part of what I do is that I'm never bored. I do a mix of data science stuff. I do a mix of lab work. I spend time under a microscope, and I do a mix of field work, and I like that I get to do so many different things in my research that I think that's my favorite part of it.
Yeah, your research covers a lot more than I would have initially thought when I think about plankton research. And like I said, you're really passionate about it, and one of the things we do on the show, it's called Inspiration Dissemination, is to inspire others. Which you're obviously doing, but another tradition that we have is we ask you to provide some advice. Now, this advice can be to anyone. It could be to a budding plankton scientist or, yeah, anyone, and any advice that you have to offer.
I guess this is advice that I would give myself and other probably early career scientists, is that research isn't everything. Like I said, this is advice I probably would have given myself too a while back, and sometimes I have to remind myself that, you know, it's okay to be a person. And I think that having hobbies and interests outside of research is just as important as being passionate about your research. And so I guess that would be kind of my advice, is don't be consumed.
Yeah, I think that's super useful, especially for grad students to hear. And it's easy to get overwhelmed in our research, but we live in Oregon. It's such a beautiful place and there's so much to do.
Yeah, and I find myself to be a better scientist and a better researcher when I'm able to do things outside of research and science and have hobbies and hang out with my friends.
Right, absolutely.
Cool. Well, we have one final tradition, which is that you get to pick your outro song. Do you want to tell us a bit about what you picked?
Yes. So my outro song is... Oh, which one?
The Rhythm
of the Night. Oh, The Rhythm of the Night. All right. So when we're on these research cruises, I usually work on the night shift. So we work... It's not even like a traditional night shift. It's a really weird 3 p.m. to 3 a.m. thing. We're basically throwing our plankton imager into the water and monitoring it. And it can be a really high stress kind of situation. And I usually kind of alleviate that stress within the night crew by playing some 90s disco.
There you go.
All right.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. But first, just wanted to thank you for being on the show. This was great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, guys.
Cool.
And with that, this is The Rhythm of the Night by Papi.
Thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, tell your friends about it and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at KBVRID.
This theme music was performed by the OSU Drumline, and the intro jingle was created by Olin Hamann. Special thanks to the supporting staff at KBVR that allow this show and podcast to be possible.
This show was started by Jean Kamvar and Joey Hulbert in 2012. To learn about our current hosts, other graduate students at Oregon State, or if you want to be part of the show, visit our website at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration. Thanks again for listening, and stay curious, my friends.